Welcome to Engaging Experts, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with influential attorneys. Our guests will describe their practice and expertise. Then we will go deep on various topics related to effectively using expert witnesses.
Hey everyone, John Corgan here. I am one of the co-hosts of this show, and we have got a great guest for you, which we're going to get to in a second. He's a celebrated, amazing individual who's got a wealth of knowledge and experience, and we're going to get to it in just a second. But before I do, this episode is brought to you by Roundtable Group, the expert on experts. For more than 25 years, Roundtable Group has helped litigators to locate, assess, and engage the best and most qualified expert witnesses. Roundtable Group is a great complement to any litigator's expert witness quest, and their search is always free of charge. Their skilled team will review the complaint or patent and discuss all the nuances and details of the perfect expert. They perform thorough and comprehensive research and contact the candidates to check for conflicts and confirm their availability, saving attorneys hours of time. Need an expert witness now? Visit roundtablegroup.com, or you can contact them at engagingexperts@roundtablegroup.com. And for today's guest, really impressive background, Professor Bruce Bueno de Mesquita. He's an emeritus senior fellow with the Hoover Institution and the Silver Professor of Politics at NYU, New York University. He's an expert on foreign policy and nation building. His current research focuses on political institutions, economic growth, and political change. He's also known for his research on policy forecasting for national security and for business concerns. His most recent book is The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents, with Alastair Smith. But he is the author of 24 different books, about 150 different articles, and he's been profiled in all kinds of different media as well. And he also received his BA degree in 1967 from Queens College. He got his MA degree in political science from the University of Michigan and PhD from the University of Michigan as well. Bruce, it's an honor to have you here. And I have with me also the CEO and co-founder of Roundtable Group, Russ Rosenzweig, who, Russ, I wanted to throw it over to you real quickly because you have got a really interesting background and connection with game theory, which of course is Bruce's specialty. So I'll turn it over to you to just tell us a little bit about that background and that history.
Sure. Hey, John, I'm happy to. I'm really thrilled to introduce Bruce because he really has a small but important role to play in the founding of Roundtable Group over 25 years ago. You know, I was studying game theory at Northwestern University, and I had the privilege of studying with some superstars like Roger Meyerson, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in economics. But kind of secretly, I also loved taking history classes and comparative religion classes and political science classes. And Bruce has weaved together all of these fields into just a beautiful dynamic tapestry of different kinds of areas of expertise. And it was because of people like Bruce and Roger and the many other world-class teachers that I studied under in college. That was the whole inspiration for founding Roundtable Group, to bring people like Bruce to the world of commerce and to help them, you know, like rock stars typically have agents and business managers. We wanted to help experts like Bruce to, you know, be engaged more frequently in the consulting and commercial context, and particularly, as everybody knows, in the expert witness context, which is what Roundtable Group's focus is. And the reason I'm so thrilled to have Bruce here as one of our very, very first pioneering podcast participants is because, unlike the thousands of other experts that we spend our time introducing to lawyers to serve as expert witnesses, Bruce has a product and a technique and a framework for helping lawyers regarding settlement agreements. And we all know, John, that, you know, 99% of cases settle. though it could take months or years before people finally get around to getting serious about settlement discussions. And among Bruce's many, many topics of expertise, the one I really want to highlight here is his ability to help lawyers not only using game theory, figure out what a likely settlement agreement will be, like what the amount will be, but also to have leverage and have an ability to change that amount and make it higher or lower based on a number of techniques, arguments, persuasion skills, things they can do. And Bruce really has mastered this art. And not a lot of lawyers know about, Bruce and Roundtable Group's ability to, help them with regard to settlement agreements. So I'm so thrilled to introduce Bruce and have you guys really discuss this in more depth.
Yes, Bruce. So I want to turn to you, and thank you, Russ, for that great introduction. But Bruce, I want to turn to you. So for those who stumble upon this episode, and at the risk of kind of dumbing it down a little bit, could you explain to all the listeners what applied game theory is?
Sure. Thank you, Russ. Those were very nice remarks. Applied game theory is a way of understanding how people deal with each other strategically, taking into account what they believe the other person is going to do if they make this choice or that choice or a different action. It's playing multidimensional chess. So in the context of litigation, there are always multiple players, multiple stakeholders with an interest in shaping what the outcome of settlement discussions will look like. And game theory is a tool, if you are using a dynamic model, that can help you figure out what are the other people going to do, what will incentivize them to do what you would like them to do, and how can you get them to make a deal that is better for you.
Great summation. So, and you have a computer model that you've been honing, developing for 30 years or so that applies all of this, correct?
Alas, it's 40 years. I used to be very young. Yes. So the process is computerized. It takes surprisingly little information to work out what other people are going to do and to work out what you can do to change what they're going to do. So really all you have to know is who's trying to influence the decision for each of those people. What do they say they want? What is the outcome they're advocating? Not what's in their heart of hearts. What are they saying they want, which is a strategically adopted position? Mm-hmm. How high a priority is it for them? They got lots of other things they have to deal with. How important is this particular problem? How open are they to listening to counter arguments to your argument? How much clout can they bring to bear? And do they have a veto over the outcome or not? If you just know those few things, you can work out with significantly over 90% accuracy what everybody is going to do, what everybody will agree to, and how you can get them to agree to an outcome that is closer to what you want than what they want. So in the litigation settlement arena, this model has been used a very large number of times. And on average, it produces 25 to 40% better settlement terms than the client expected to get, whether they are, as they usually are, on the defense side, or as they occasionally are, on the plaintiff side. So lower cost when they're the defendants and higher cost when they're the plaintiffs. People leave a lot of money on the table.
One thing that I find fascinating about this is that you've applied it in a range of situations, including foreign nations. And there was a study by the CIA that found that your predictions for the computer model hit the bullseye twice as often as their own analysts' predictions. How is it that you developed a model that works well both in that context and in litigation context?
So very early on, I realized that litigation and international conflict are exactly the same problem. And pretty much all business discussions that are not driven by market forces are the same problem. That is, there are people on different sides. They are trying to persuade the other side to do what they want through a mix of making settlement offers and coercive pressure, making it costly not to do what they want. And you have the choice. You can make a deal. You can fight back. You can walk away and so forth. That's what war is. That's what litigation is. That's what mergers and acquisitions are. That's pretty much what all issues in life that are not driven by markets are. So I had that insight. I wrote a computer model. The original model was very primitive. And it turned out to capture the attention of the U.S. intelligence community because it made some predictions that were very different from what they were expecting on the issues at the time. And it turned out to be right. The intelligence community has used this model about 2,000 times. And it is, as I say, the same problem for lawyers as it is for the intelligence community.
So you've probably observed a tremendous number of attorneys and litigators use this model. What are the most successful applications that you've seen? How do you see lawyers use it to their advantage? Like, do you see, are they a more flexible negotiator? Give me some success metrics that you see in the lawyers themselves who use this model successfully.
So there's not an off-the-shelf right strategy for all problems. Each problem has a unique configuration of those variables that I mentioned for all of the players, and that produces a unique optimal settlement. What are the characteristics of a lawyer who uses this successfully? A strong ego, a person who is willing to entertain the possibility that their data with a mathematical model can produce better solution concepts than they came up with on their own. That's a hard thing for a lot of people to accept. There's some attorneys I've worked with for decades. They have that characteristic. They have a deep interest in getting the best result for their client. They don't have a huge ego involvement with do what I say, as opposed to let's look at other ways to look at the problem. That is the key.
Interesting. Now, in the model, I understand can provide round by round simulation of a negotiation. So as things evolve and change during negotiation, you plug in these new metrics and things change. Describe that. Explain that to me.
Okay. So first, the model itself is dynamic. So these round by round, that is exchanges of information, occur within the model's logic. It predicts what is optimal for me to say today? What's going to be the response? And what will that produce tomorrow and the day after and the day after? So it's not just constantly updating the information. It is the model has already projected step by step how the process will unfold. And so it gives you insights into when is the time to say we should stop talking and take this deal because it's going to head in a worse direction perhaps in the future, or it's getting better and we should keep talking. There are times when new things are learned where there's a realization that you need to make some change to the inputs because something there's been an external shock, which has changed the trajectory. I have literally on some litigations sat in a room next door to where discussions are taking place, instructed the client to take a certain number of coffee breaks and come in, update me and plug in some new data if necessary and go back into the room. But most of the time, the model is correctly working out what the trajectory of the conversations are. I mean, in the early models, it was all very primitive. Now the dynamics are quite powerful. And so the user has really the opportunity to play out the negotiation before ever sitting down with the other side.
That's got to be It's got to be like, once you've used that model, you couldn't imagine going back to not using that model when you've had that kind of roadmap to map it out for you. I'm curious, though, when you're working with attorneys, how often does the model spit out a scenario or a suggestion that then that lawyer, you make it to the lawyer and you say, here's what you should do. And then the lawyer says, no way. No, I couldn't do that, or I couldn't imagine that that would produce the result that we're looking for. In other words, how often does it completely surprise them?
Oh, quite often. I would say that 80% of the time, the model produces an approach to the problem that differs from what the attorney had in mind. The percentage who then say, oh, no, there's no way that couldn't possibly be right, that's much smaller. Because the people who use the model repeatedly people that is the value right. added. Right. To tell an attorney, you're right, it's going to play out just the way you think. Pay me, you know. Well, why am I? Right. Yeah, what have I right. gotten out of this?
Right.
The value added is seeing a better way through the problem, where better is defined by it produces an outcome closer to what the attorney wants for his or her client.
Got it. I imagine there's a lot of attorneys that pick up beers afterwards saying, you were right. You were right. Well, I didn't think it would work, but it worked.
I've got tons of emails from attorneys that say things like, it's like magic. How did that happen? They did just what you said.
Any scenarios where, I imagine you only would represent one side, but are there ever any scenarios where if both sides are using the model, what happens?
So my dream is that both sides use the model. And I've given talks to mediation groups and so forth with the hope that that would happen. What would happen if it were used by both sides is that you would get to a settlement faster at lower cost to both sides, clients, and you would get to a settlement that was not optimal for one side, but jointly optimal. That, of course, is why it has never happened, because once the client realizes that there is an optimal path to the best possible outcome they can get, it's not the same as that jointly optimal outcome. They want to go down the path for the best that they can get for their client. I've had one occasion. It was not in a litigation. It was in a case where a firm had an internal battle and was splitting, where I persuaded the CEO of the firm to let me talk to the other side about doing a joint analysis. And when I went to the leader of the opposite faction, he had experience with the model. He knew it worked. I'd been under retainer with this firm for a long time. He said, I know this works, but so-and-so sent you to talk to me. So how can I trust that you're not really going to be doing what's just good for him?
Sure.
So he didn't do it. And
yeah,
he would have been much better off if he had, but that's another matter.
What about courts? Courts are always trying to do things more efficiently. And these days they have limited resources. Are courts, they seem to have a vested interest in widespread adoption.
I don't think that that's right.
No.
Courts don't have an interest in the outcome. I mean, courts certainly have an interest in settlement because
faster
dockets are packed.
Yeah.
So I could imagine judges routinely will say to attorneys in a dispute, go work this out.
Right.
But I would be very surprised if they steered them towards using a tool. Arbitrators, mediators, I can well imagine that. Their interest is to see a settlement, and they don't have the same constraints on them that a judge does. But overwhelmingly in the litigation arena, the people who use the model are attorneys, not the courts.
Got it. This has been fascinating. Anything in particular that we haven't covered that if I'm an attorney listening to this and we haven't used your model before, that they should know that would persuade them that they should be?
So it's very little work for the attorney. There is some upfront effort. They have to assemble a small group of people who are very knowledgeable about the problem. Those people will provide the input data, that is, who are the stakeholders, what are they each likely to be advocating, how high a priority is it, and so forth. They will never be asked what will happen. We know well from research by people like Phil Tetlock that experts know the facts, but they don't have good judgment about how things will unfold in the future. That's the model's comparative advantage. Once the attorney puts that little bit of time in to assemble a group of experts and to get those experts to sit down and answer the questions that will lead to numerical data about the variables, the next commitment of the attorney is to listen to a briefing on here's how things are likely to unfold. Here are the things that you can do to make them unfold better. Here's what you could get. Here's what you otherwise will get. Here's what you do to get it. And then they're off and running. My little consulting firm is always happy to follow up after the briefing. If they have questions, well, did you look at our doing this? Did you look at our doing that? Generally, the answer is yes. But if the answer is no, we go back, we'll do it. If they learn some piece of information that is they believe is material and changes the input data, somebody has a heart attack and is no longer in the game or what have you, we'll rerun it for them and tell them, did this matter? And if it mattered, how much did it matter? If their team of experts are uncertain about some of the data, for example, well, I don't know how high a priority this is for so-and-so. Well, we'll simulate it. If it's this high, it's that high. And if it generally doesn't matter if there are a number of players, but if it does matter, then we will help the attorney to see innocuous things they can do to find out which is the right number.
Mm. Now,
a little phone call, for example, to say to somebody, I'd like to talk about this matter with you. Can we have lunch tomorrow? Hmm. If the answer is yes, this is a high priority for that person. If the person says, I'm very busy, call me in 3 months, you know, it's a very low priority. You've pinned down that value.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know that they've given you data.
That's great. Now, over 40 years, computing power has changed tremendously, of course. And there's a lot of talk, especially mainstream media, about AI, the advent of AI. How do you see those changes in computing power and AI affecting your model?
So when I started doing this, I had an upper bound of about 12 players. Then it went to 47. There were just memory limits. Today, I can handle any finite number of players in a contest. When I started doing this in the a project in the early 80s, for example, I was asked to make some predictions about changes in the constitution of Turkey. I ran this on a commercial time on a mainframe computer. And at the end of a week, I had nothing because it had timed out. It couldn't do all the calculations. Today, by the time my finger comes off the button that tells the model to run, I would have that solved for a projection 2 years into the future.
Wow.
So things have changed a lot. There are artificial intelligence components that I've designed into this model. I had some such components 40 years ago. It was for its time a pretty sophisticated model. Today, the computational capabilities are such that it's just incredible how complex a problem can be, and you can solve it in a matter of moments.
Yeah, fascinating. Before we wrap up, I know we're running short on time, and I do want to get to your books, which you've got in the works, numbers 25 and 26, which are still on the ways. But before I do that, you co-authored a book with an active sitting Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. That's fascinating. Not every day you hear about that sort of thing. What was that experience like?
It was kind of a cool experience. Condi and I were colleagues at Stanford, and she and some other colleagues had a puzzle that they didn't know how to solve, which was, how could people who were way outside the mainstream, as they perceived it, of their country's politics rise to the highest office in their land? There are two examples in the book, Ronald Reagan becoming president of the United States and Yeltsin becoming the president of an independent Russia and creating an independent Russia. So I offered a simple model to explain that. Condi then, Bush got elected and she went off to Washington. So we worked on the book while she was secretary. I believe this is the only instance of an academic book, not a memoir, not a political book, an academic book published by an academic press, University of Michigan Press, done by any sitting cabinet minister, but certainly the only one by Secretary of State. And it was a lot of fun. It was, you know, kind of an interesting distraction for all of us.
Yeah, what a cool experience. All right, your upcoming books, Popes and Kings, Competition and the Creation of Western Exceptionalism, is one that's on its way. And then you've got a second one as well, Domestic Political Instability, which you're working on with Alastair Smith. Tell us about these upcoming books that you've got on the way.
So Popes and Kings, no math, no statistics in the book, but game theory reasoning and lots of data evidence makes the case that variations across Europe in its prosperity, in its secularism, in its level of parliamentary government and democracy, and in its tolerance for competing religions and the origin of the Protestant Reformation, all can be shown logically and with evidence to be products of an obscure agreement, the Concordat of Worms, signed between the Holy Roman Emperor and Pope Calixtus II on September 23rd, 1122. This is, you know, 400 years before Martin Luther. You can, from the logic of the Concordat, a little game of what the deal was, you can predict not only that something like the Protestant Reformation would happen, but when it would happen. And you can predict which parts of Europe would become wealthy and which parts of Europe would not become wealthy, even to the point that if you take the conditions of the agreement in 1122 and you look at the differences in Europe today, you can predict differences in per capita income from the deal back then. You can predict differences in life expectancy. You can even predict differences per million population in the probability of winning Nobel Prizes in the sciences. The Concordat of Worms shaped modern Europe in a way that has been completely missed by historians and by political economists. So that's what that book's about.
Fascinating. And then Domestic Political Instability.
So Domestic Political Instability is about what leaders do in anticipation that their inner circle or the masses will rise up against them. Not just in terms of crushing uprisings, but what it takes for them to make their government more democratic, more liberal, and what it takes to make their government more autocratic and more oppressive. So this is grounded in theorizing that Alastair Smith and I have worked on for many years, as well with James Morrow and Randolph Severson, on what has come to be known as the Selectorate Theory, in a new format that is more dynamic and provides an explanation of the strategic decision to change how you govern.
Great. All right. And you know what? I think some people would kick me if I didn't ask this last question, but we're recording this in December of 2020. And without diving into politics or anything like that, are there any, you know, considering we've had a pandemic for the last 9 months, is there anything I need to know about? In other words, anything you've modeled out that's on the way that I should probably be warned about? You just have to ask you that.
Well, I will. I'll tell you something that the selector theory tells us, which is a good thing and will be a disappointing thing as well. Whatever one's politics are, The Biden administration's policies will not look very different from the Trump administration's policies. The rhetoric will be different, but the policies will not be very different. Governments that depend on a very large number of people to keep them in power have very little wiggle room on policy. The United States is such a country. So, you know, if you are China, where you depend on very few people, you can get huge swings in policy. And so you can get huge swings in the economy and so forth. That's not true in what I call very large coalition governments, mature democracies. So I'm fond of pointing out to my students, for instance, that the United States is the largest economy in the world, and China today is the second largest economy. And then I ask them, I will ask you, what was the second largest economy in the world in 1890?
1890, second largest in 1890. I'm going to guess like the Ottoman Empire or something like that. No.
It was China.
China.
It was China.
In 1890.
China, it's very big population. So the aggregate.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So China went through huge swings in policy. It went from being second largest to being a minuscule, relatively minuscule economy in between. And now it's back to being second largest. Whereas large coalition governments like the United States chug along slowly but steadily, moving up.
Interesting.
So there won't be big changes.
So that's assuring for people who are a little bit worried about China taking over the United States.
Yes. Should be.
Good to know. Bruce, this has been wonderful. Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, where can people go to learn more about you or learn more about the work that you do or check out your books?
Well, they can go to Amazon to find the books. They will love The Dictator's Handbook, which is the selector theory without math. They can go to look me up at NYU, look me up at the Hoover Institution. I've got a rather large web presence. A lot of people have things to say about me, bad, good, and indifferent. The selector theory's got a Wikipedia page. Dictator's Handbook's got a Wikipedia page. Predictioneer's Game, which is on this forecasting model, has a Wikipedia page. I have no involvement in any of those pages. I don't write Wikipedia pages. I just do my thing. And I have a Wikipedia page, so they can
Google the name. You can find all those links. Excellent, Bruce.
Yeah, there are not a lot of Bueno de Mesquitas out there, though, more than you would think.
Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Engaging Experts. Be sure to click subscribe so you don't miss our future episodes.